Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, short-term rentals are booming in Ulster County, but at what cost? A new report shows a 220% spike over the last decade, putting serious strain on local housing. We talk with the Ulster County Comptroller about what it all means for residents. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and help is always available. We talk with Erica Thaxton from the Victims Intervention Program about the services they provide and how our community can support survivors. Confused by labels like organic, free-range, or sustainably produced? This Sunday at Damascus, a free workshop to help you decode those labels and what they really mean. We'll talk with the workshop leader, plus Farm Fest in Jeffersonville, and a night of Brazilian jazz at the Cooperage Project. It's all coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Authorities are looking for the motive in yesterday's attack on an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Dallas. One detainee was killed, two others wounded. Officials say the gunman took his own life. Former Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security Juliet Kayham says officials have disclosed evidence linked to the shooter that seems similar to other killings.
The most important thing is at least what's been disclosed by the FBI director is that one of the casings that he was using had the words anti-ICE. So you're going to begin with that. And it's very similar to recent killings that we've seen, both in Charlie Kirk and this United Health CEO killing, in which these men are using these casings and writing on them.
She spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Three men implicated in the September 11, 2001 attacks have asked a federal court to reinstate their plea deals. These were reached with the U.S. government last year, but later canceled. NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer reports one of the men includes the alleged mastermind of the attack.
Wednesday was the deadline for three of the 9/11 defendants to appeal the rejection of their plea deals. And all three of them did appeal, including the alleged ringleader, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They want the full D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to hear their case. If it takes the case but doesn't rule in their favor, they can still appeal to the Supreme Court. The plea deals, if allowed, would let them plead guilty and spend life in prison rather than face the death penalty. Prosecutors have said plea deals would be the best resolution since the case has still not gone to trial nearly a quarter century after the attacks. Sasha Pfeiffer, NPR News.
Coffee retailer Starbucks says it will close hundreds of stores in North America and lay off nearly 1,000 workers. It's an effort to reverse the company's poor sales over more than a year. Despite the numerous store closures, Starbucks says these are only about 1% of its store count. Stocks opened lower this morning as the National Association of Realtors reported a modest drop in home sales last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 180 points in early trading.
Sales of existing homes fell by 0.2% in August, extending a months-long slump. The number of homes on the market was also down, but the average selling price inched up to more than $422,000. Revised figures from the Commerce Department show the U.S. economy grew faster during the spring than had been reported. GDP grew at an annual pace of 3.8% in April, May, and June, up from an earlier estimate of 3.3%. The upward revision primarily reflects stronger consumer spending. The nation's trade deficit narrowed in August as higher tariffs took effect. The trade gap had widened the previous month as importers raced to beat those higher taxes. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 130 points. This is NPR. Another swarm of drones in Denmark last night forced Danish officials to close an airport. That's the second time this week this has happened. Danish officials say a professional actor is responsible, and they may officially consult NATO. Researchers say harvesting and coastal development along the California coast have nearly depleted the Olympia oyster population. The oysters were once an important food source for Native Americans and gold rushers. Jill Repluga reports from Huntington Beach.
Every 2 weeks, Craig Schopner pulls up strings of discarded oyster shells from restaurants hanging off of his dock in Huntington Harbor. He checks to see whether any baby oysters have latched on.
Yeah, I don't see any oysters yet.
Schopner and some 80 of his neighbors around the harbor have been caring for these shell strings since the spring. The nonprofit organization Coastkeeper will soon collect them and transfer any baby oysters, called spat, to a nearby wetlands area. The goal is to rebuild the once abundant oyster beds along the coast to improve water quality and help prevent erosion in the face of rising seas. For NPR News, I'm Jill Replogle in Huntington Beach.
Doctors in London say a new treatment for the genetic disease known as Huntington's has helped slow it by a significant amount. The disease kills brain cells and causes involuntary movements in the body. The treatment involved up to 18 hours of brain surgery. But the doctors say the results are spectacular and that these demonstrate a successful treatment for the disease for the first time. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Legacy Box, committed to saving aging tapes and photos by bringing them to life in digital form, then making them accessible in Legacy Box Cloud. Learn more at legacybox.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Over the last decade, the number of short-term rentals in Ulster County has jumped by 220%. That's according to a new report released on Monday from Ulster County Comptroller Mark Gallagher about the rapid growth of short-term rentals and their increasing pressure on the county's housing market. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Ulster County Comptroller Gallagher, who shared the latest from the report.
So, you know, as controller, I receive constituent calls all the time on a variety of issues. And one of the issues that we really get a lot of phone calls on is housing availability and a housing crisis. And I think, you know, everyone in the county would agree it's exceptionally hard to find housing, especially affordable housing right now. And we have seen this tremendous growth in short-term rentals. So we wanted to look at, you know, what has the impact been on the housing stock? How many housing units do we have overall? And then how much of that housing is allocated to short-term rentals? And then we decided we really should break it down by town because we think there's a big difference between the towns. And lo and behold, that is what the report showed.
Yeah, I was looking at the report before we hopped on the call. And like you said, like each town or village is so different in terms of the percentage of short-term rentals. Some are higher than others. For example, like the towns of Shandaken and Woodstock, their short-term rentals are anywhere between 7 to 9% of their total housing units, whereas like Ellenville, less than 1% of their units are short-term rentals. I'm curious if you could share more about what's behind those gaps.
So, you know, the county has an initiative called the Housing Smart Communities Initiative, which is really encouraging all of our towns and villages in the city to build more housing, to allow more housing through zoning and through planning practices. We actually provide financial support for that. And as a part of that initiative, you know, the planners for the county, the housing planners, recommend that communities keep short-term rentals under 2% of the total housing stock. Mm. I think what has happened is that places that regulated housing being converted to short-term rentals early and strong in a strong way saw less increase. And those communities that sort of delayed putting in regulation while their housing supply was being consumed by short-term rentals really saw the brunt of it. Woodstock and Shandaken, as you noted, are the most impacted, but City of Kingston, which has a requirement that owners occupy the residence or else it be limited to a very small number of units, really has kept it, you know, at a low percentage. And the same is true with the Village of New Paltz, for example, under 1%. They require all short-term rentals be owner-occupied. So enforcement is a challenge for these towns. And we've been hearing from, you know, towns like Olive, for example, that they've had to hire additional building inspectors just to implement their short-term rental law. So it is creating a burden on local municipalities to, you know, not only make sure that these units are safe, but make sure that they're permitted correctly. And we have seen tragedies where, you know, a short-term rental across the river in Dutchess County, for example, had no smoke detectors and people died. So, wow. You know, it really is important to make sure that these things are, you know, managed well.
Yeah. I think you sit in an interesting intersection where you're getting these phone calls from residents, like, you know, renters, but then you're also in constant communication with town and village officials. I know you talked about a little bit already, but what have you heard from the residents, especially about how this surge in short-term rentals are impacting their ability to find affordable housing?
It really has taken units off the market. We can see properties that we knew were former hotels. I'm just going to give you an example on the 28 corridor where there were little cabins that used to be long-term rentals that now have converted to short-term rentals. Granted, those used to be hotels back in the day, right? Another 30, 40 years ago. So those are of less concern than, you know, the everyday single family residents that we're seeing being converted. And it really is stretching communities. And we're also finding communities are being hollowed out. And what I mean by that is there are entire blocks or roads where most of the houses now are short-term rentals. There aren't full-time year-round residents. This leaves less people to volunteer for the PTA, less kids to go to school, less people to serve on the fire department, less people to work in jobs in town. And then we have employers saying we cannot recruit employees because there is nowhere for them to live. And that's not just on the rental side, that's on the purchase side, you know, where we've seen just this tremendous growth in real estate sales and many properties over the last 3 or 4 years going for cash offers. So it's really created a challenging housing environment all around. And the county, you know, has a number of housing initiatives to try to address this, but it takes years to build new housing. So we're really in that gap period right now where we're struggling.
Yeah, I definitely hear you on that. I mean, we're facing similar challenges here in Sullivan County, as you described, kind of this ripple effect where there's the shortage of affordable rentals, but then also that means that there's no place where, or there's minimal places where the workforce can live affordably. I mean, I'm a renter myself, so I definitely hear that as well. I'm curious just to clarify, what kinds of properties are being considered a short-term rental as you pull this report together?
A short-term rental is anything that rents for a period of time of less than 30 days. And Ulster County has a contract with a vendor, Granicus, that operates a platform called Host Compliance, where they actually pay people to sit and look online and try to identify what properties are renting as short-term rentals and then report that back to the county. It is very challenging to identify short-term rentals because they can come on and off the market at a whim. And they may only rent for a period of time. I've actually heard from several STR owners since the release of the report, very angry that we're not identifying that, you know, this could be a family that lives full time in their house, but goes to Europe for a week and rents out their property. I believe that to be the minority of properties. I think the vast majority of STR properties are full time short term rentals, meaning they rent for less than 30 days at a time.
That's really helpful. And, you know, Comptroller, as the county looks ahead, I'm curious what you think needs to happen to kind of both address this housing crunch that many residents are feeling, while also making sure that Ulster County remains a welcoming place and an attractive place for tourism.
Absolutely. Well, one thing that I think is going to help vastly is the legislation that Senator Michelle Hinchey spearheaded for the short-term rental registry, which is going to require every short-term rental that platform that operates in New York State to report who is listing on their properties. They don't do that now. They don't tell us anything. That is going to help, as well as they're going to be collecting sales tax and occupancy tax revenues. We believe that there are probably short-term rentals that, while they might be paying occupancy tax through Airbnb, may not be paying sales tax. They may not even be aware it's required. So that's going to be one thing that helps us going forward. I also think building new units is going, you know, of housing generally. And we see about, just with county funded projects, about 600 units in the pipeline. So I think that's going to be, you know, a beneficial as well. But I'm not sure, you know, how long it's going to take before we see an easing. And of course, you know, we are a tourism economy and we do want people to visit. We've been very hostile to the building of new hotels and new, you know, commercial development in general. And maybe we will see sort of more of a patient approach to potential new hotel development in the future, now that people have seen what the short-term rental market can do to the housing supply and to communities in terms of hauling it out. So, you know, I have hope for the future. I do think, you know, we're going to continue to be a strong tourism economy. And I think that the short-term rental registry and new housing coming on the market will really make this an easier challenge to face in the future.
Before we sign off, Comptroller, is there anything else that you want to lift up that maybe we haven't discussed that you feel is important for folks to know?
Yeah, I do. One of the surprising findings that caught me off guard was that so many of the short-term rental units that are being advertised are one bedrooms or studios. And, you know, while we say out of all the housing in the county being offered for short-term rentals, it's 3% of all total housing units. That's a big number, but it's 7% of all one bedroom and studio apartments. That means that, you know, single individuals, seniors, you know, young couples just starting out are really having a hard time accessing the housing market. You know, the state law under the Emergency Rental Tenant Protection Act says anything under 5% vacancy is a crisis for sure. Well, we've got, you know, 7% of all studio and one bedrooms offline as short-term rentals. We've created a housing crisis in that small bedroom market.
Folks can find the full report on the Comptroller's website, comptroller.ulsterncountyny.gov. We've been chatting with Ulster County Comptroller March Gallagher about their new report on the impact of short-term rentals in Ulster County. Comptroller, it was such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. You too. Thank you so much. Love JFF. Keep up the great work.
And thank you for that. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we talk with Erica Thaxton from Victims Intervention Program about the services they provide for victims of domestic violence and how our community can support survivors. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, I'm Brett Barry, host of CatsCast, the Catskills podcast, with some exciting news. We're bringing our award-winning series to Radio Catskill. Join us every Saturday at 11 as we explore the stories, people, and ideas shaping our region. Culture, history, sustainability, literature, the arts, and more. That's CatsCast with me, Brett Barry, Saturdays at 11, beginning October 4th on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and today we're talking about the critical work being done right here in our region to support survivors. Joining us is Erica Thaxton, medical advocate with the Victims Intervention Program, or VIP, which serves Wayne and Pike counties. VIP operates 24/7, 365 days a year, offering everything from crisis intervention to long-term support. Erica, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me back again. I always love talking to you.
It's good to talk to you, too. And for folks who aren't familiar with VIP, can you explain the work you do for survivors here in our community?
Absolutely. So we are a nonprofit victim service organization, and we serve the residents of Wayne and Pike counties whose lives have been impacted by domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, and other major crimes or life trauma.
But a lot of people know VIP and the crisis hotline that you might provide, that you provide, but you do so much more. Can you walk us through the range of services you provide and, you know, everything from an emergency shelter to long-term counseling, long-term advocacy?
Absolutely. So we work with anyone, men, women, children, whether they are directly affected as a survivor or their family, friends of a survivor, or they have no direct relation at all. Maybe they're a neighbor or a teacher or a healthcare provider or anybody. All of our services are free and they're confidential. We, as you said, are open 24/7. So those emergency crisis around-the-clock type services are our crisis hotline, which can be reached by phone, text, or through a chat feature on our website. We also have the emergency shelter for those that are actively fleeing an abusive or trafficking situation. We do medical and legal accompaniment, and we can even offer safe sheltering for pets of the survivors that are within our emergency shelter. But otherwise, as you said, we also have the individual and group counseling. We do a lot of court and medical advocacy work, school-based programs, prevention education, community outreach, you know, anything and everything. Our goal is to walk alongside survivors, not just in that moment of crisis, but in their healing journey as they rebuild their lives.
There have been repeated delays in Pennsylvania passing their budget. Pike County officials are even have passed a resolution calling on lawmakers to end the repeated delays in passing the budget because it's impacting their services. It's impacting your services as well. That has not been passed for the funding of the victim services budget. How does that uncertainty affect your work, and what impact does it have on survivors and their families?
So the fiscal year starts July 1. So programs such as ours has not received any federal funding since June because this state budget hasn't been passed. So this being a critical issue doesn't even amount to the criticality of it. You know, programs like ours really do rely heavily on these state funding to keep the doors open. So for survivors, without the budget being passed, it creates that uncertainty, right? There may be longer waits to get in with an advocate for counseling or fewer resources for emergency shelter. There are a lot of programs in Pennsylvania that have had to lay off a large amount of staff. Some of them may even face closure because of this. You know, for us, it's doing more with less, which is completely unsustainable when you have real human lives on the line here. You know, if there's one thing I could ask for people who are listening, especially anyone living within Pennsylvania, please contact your state representatives and let them know that victim services matter. Every survivor needs support, a path forward, and the only way to make that possible is through stable funding.
And how long do you think you'll be able to sustain without this budget getting passed?
You know, I wish I could give you a number on that. You know, we are very fortunate to where our executive director has very much diversified our funding sources as much as possible for times like these, should they occur. However, again, the majority of that does come from our state budget. So we are doing everything we can. We are fortunate that we have not had to lay off any staff yet, and we hope to continue to do that for as long as possible.
And again, this is the Pennsylvania state budget. It's caught up in some Harrisburg politics, it seems. And are you any indications that you would get the same amount or more that you had received in the past, or are you looking at any potential state cuts?
So there was a lot of talk about state cuts, and that I think is part of the holdup here, is getting the agreement on both sides of, you know, the Democratic and Republican parties as far as what they can agree or what their terms will be. Of course, having huge cuts is never beneficial either, but at least it's still something, you know, so hopefully they can come to a resolution on this sooner rather than later.
October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Why is this month so important, and what message do you want listeners to take away about domestic violence and sexual assault?
And so October being Domestic Violence Awareness Month, or DVAM, it's such a time that we can shine light on that issue that too often stays hidden and silent. You know, domestic violence doesn't just affect couples. It affects children, families, communities at large. It doesn't discriminate. It will affect everybody's lives in any way possible. The theme for this year's DVAM is hashtag everyone knows someone, because the truth is we all do. You know, DVAM gives us a chance to start those conversations, support survivors, and even correct some of those common myths. A lot of people believe that domestic violence is just the physical. Well, Tim, I can hurt somebody a lot of other ways than just physical, right? And oftentimes it's those other ways that are so much harder to even heal from. It all is rooted in power and control. It includes things like isolation, threats, or coercive measures, maybe financial abuse. These are all ways that you can gain and maintain power and control over another person without ever raising a hand. Yes, throughout October, we really try to honor survivors, remember those that we've lost, and recommit to building our safer communities. Most importantly, it's about spreading hope and a call to action. If you are suffering, help is out there. Healing is possible, and every single one of us has a very big role to play in ending domestic violence.
You also have some upcoming programs, some trainings and events, like the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Training in October. In 2026, mm-hmm. your Medical Advocacy Conference, to your ongoing professional trainings. Can you highlight what these events mean for the community and for survivors and give us a little more info?
Yes. So for our SANE training and our Medical Advocacy Conference, these are things that we hold in conjunction with a sister agency of ours from Lackawanna and Susquehanna counties. That's WRC. The SANE training is a four-day training throughout 4 days in October. It is open to any registered nurse or advanced practice nurse that is living in, or working in Wayne, Pike, Lackawanna, or Susquehanna counties, as long as they have an active Pennsylvania nursing license. These nurses play a crucial role when survivors go to the hospital to make sure that they receive that compassionate and trauma-informed care. You know, the Medical Advocacy Conference, that is held in April of every year. This will be our fourth one. It's super exciting. We bring together healthcare providers, community resource professionals, advocates, survivors, anybody, really to help strengthen our overall response to survivors at the community level as well as the healthcare and medical level.
Beyond raising awareness during October and during this conversation as well, how can listeners support VIP's work? I know you're looking for adopt-a-family donors, sponsors, volunteers. What are some of the best ways people can step up right now?
Yes. So right now, of course, yes, the Adopt-A-Family program, we are always looking for donors, and that is to help ensure that survivors are able to have safe and joyful holiday seasons. We also have sponsorship opportunities for businesses and individuals who want to invest in prevention or survivor services. The sponsors are especially important when it comes to some of our events, such as our Medical Advocacy Conference. Volunteers, I can never say enough about, whether it's helping at events, sharing information, or just handing out our information, right? We can't do everything that we do without the help of others. Every small action makes a difference. So please, if anyone is interested, reach out to us, reach out to your local program, because it's not just us. We all need help in order to safely provide these services.
And let's remind folks how they can reach you, learn more about your services.
So for us, you know, anyone living in Wayne and Pike counties, if you or someone you know may be experiencing abuse, call us 24 hours a day or text us 570-253-4401. There is a domestic violence and sexual assault program in every single county. So whether you live in Pennsylvania or you live in another state, Google or search for your state domestic violence or sexual assault coalition webpage, and you can look up the local county from there. So for Pennsylvania, the coalition site is pcadv.org for domestic violence. Our website as well is vipempowers.org. But to learn more or to get more information about resources close to where you're living, go on your state's coalition website to find your local program.
That's Erica Thaxton from the Victims Intervention Program. If you or someone you know needs help, VIP's 24-hour confidential hotline, again, is 570-253-4401. You can call that or text that number. Also, you can learn more or get involved by visiting vipempowers.org. And as Erica said, every county has a program. In New York, you can call 800-942-6906. And the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 800-799-7233. No matter where you live, you are not alone, and help is always available. Erica, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, are you confused by food labels like organic or free range? This Sunday in Damascus, Iris Gillingham will show you what they really mean for farmers, the land, and your plate. We'll learn more from Iris next. This is Radio Chatsco.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, cookbook author and television host Samin Nosrat, star of the Netflix series Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. He'll talk to Hrishikesh Hirway about her new book, Good Things, Recipes and Rituals to Share with People You Love. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at CatskillsPropertyCare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Ever wonder what cage-free, pasture-raised, or organic really mean on the food you buy? This Sunday in Damascus, Farm Arts Collective is hosting an Understanding Food Labels workshop to help clear up the confusion. We're joined now by Iris Gillingham of Gale Roots Farm, who will lead the interactive session explaining these labels, their impact on farmers, the land, and even the food we eat. Iris, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I get confused about all these things. But tell
so
us,
do I. That's why we're doing this workshop.
I was just going to ask you, why did you want to tackle this topic? Is it because you were confused as much as I am?
Yeah. Last year I was at a farming conference and a bunch of farmers were talking about how confusing it is to navigate and deal with these food labels themselves, even because so many of them are unregulated. There's a lot of terminology that can be thrown on a box that says all natural and there's no legal standard.
Yeah.
So we wanted to help consumers figure out how to buy food and know what they're getting.
There are so many terms: free range, cage free, organic, pasture raised. That's just on eggs. Can you give us a sense of why some of these things are confusing for consumers?
Absolutely. So with a lot of certification processes, there are set standards through the USDA, and there are then certifiers who can add on to that, such as like the NOFA New York certification or the Real Organic certification, which takes the USDA standard even further and goes into like animal treatment, or, you know, the NOFA New York certification doesn't allow hydroponics, which is plants that are not grown in soil. And one of the aspects about all of this is that we live in an era of greenwashing. So when you are in the grocery store and you see something that says USDA organic and it's in a plain brown packaging, and next to it there's a picture of a chicken on grass or, you know, something with leaves and it says all natural and it says like non-GMO or like different things, you're like really confused. And so some of the words and terminology has no backbone to it. There's nobody holding those farmers accountable. So corporations can just put some of the labels on stuff without having to deal with somebody coming in and auditing them, while certified farmers are actually paying a lot of money and putting a lot of time into record keeping to make sure that they are meeting the standards for like how much time their animals have outside for eggs, for instance.
Well, I was just going to ask you, but beyond the shopping choices that you have to make as a consumer and get through and navigate the confusion of all these different labels, and kind of in the back of my mind, I sort of know maybe that, okay, this is just a marketing thing that somebody's using. But what impact did these farming practices have on soil health and climate?
That's one of the big topics right now, because we're living in an era where the soil is one of the most important things when you're farming. And that has to do with dealing with climate change. That has to do with trying to keep the land from more destruction that has already been caused by agriculture. And so with, for example, organic standards like NOFA New York, they are encouraging farmers to do cover cropping and practices that are really good for the soil. One of the terms that has become really popular that people hear now a lot is regenerative. And there's only actually one regenerative certification. So a lot of times when you see the word regenerative on something, it's up for interpretation on how their soil practices are good for the soil and climate. And that is a really, you know, it gets then confusing for people because they think they're putting their money and their probably hard-earned dollar behind something that they're supporting good soil health practices, when it really, corporations are taking advantage of people and also really trying to screw with agriculture and people's understanding of agriculture.
And that also affects local farmers economically. Can you talk
Absolutely.
A little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, I think the biggest thing to do around food is to try and get to know your farmer and know where your farmers are, their practices. Talk to your farmers, get to know their practices, because there are a lot of farmers that aren't actually USDA organic certified or NOFA certified, because it's a big cost to do so, but they might practice a lot of those practices. So you can also learn a lot from just having conversation and asking open questions about their practices and getting to know them. When you drive by the farm nearby, are there cows out on grass? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's like it's a hot topic. And I will say, like, we are not going to be able to cover all of it in this conversation, but we just want to give people a little bit more information so that they can be educated consumers and eaters, because we're living in an era where food is so expensive. We want people to know what they're putting their dollar behind.
What is one of the biggest misconceptions you hear from people about food labels?
I think that a lot of people just assume they can trust food labels. And that is really a bummer to me, because I think we want to, right? We want to believe that the pretty picture of the cow on grass is real and not a stock image. But in reality, that's why certification is really important. And there have been many, many years of farmers advocating for these regulations that we have to be tighter and stricter in some ways, and to also be like working with farmers more so that it can highlight the amount of work that small farmers put into making sure their food is healthy and good.
And your Understanding Food Labels workshop, again, is Sunday in Damascus at Farm Arts Collective there on the farm. What will participants do or learn during the workshop?
We're going to do an overview of a lot of greenwashing terms. We're also going to talk about the process that it takes for farmers to get certified. And then we'll expand into a little bit more of the nuance of it as well. And also talking about gardening, like if you're interested in your own gardening, what is some of the greenwashing on fertilizers and stuff that it gets in the way with biosolids in them. And there's so much to talk about with labeling in regards to soil and food. And this workshop, which, as you said, is with Farm Arts Collective, we're going to be doing that.
And can you give us details about what people need to know if they want to attend, where they can get more information?
Yeah, you can go to farmartscollective.org, and the event is at 11 a.m. There will be a nice, lovely lunch from vegetables from Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm. And it will be in the new Farm Arts Collective space, which, if you haven't been, is beautiful.
Beautiful.
Farm Arts Collective does a lot of amazing events, like October 19th. They have a fermentation workshop. So I'm really delighted to collaborate with them on this, because their space is just lovely to be in. And it's on a farm. So we'll be having the conversation on a farm that you can then go to the Calicoon Farmers Market and get produce from.
It makes sense. It's like you planned it. No reservations required?
No reservations. It's a pay what you can at the door. And we want people to bring questions that they have and curiosity, and also just an interest in learning more about where their food is coming from.
For folks who may not be able to make it to the workshop, or folks that are listening outside the area, what's one quick tip you'd give them to make more informed choices at the grocery store?
I would say question your labels as much as you can, and try to do some research if you have capacity. And a great way to do that is to talk to farmers you know who go through the certification processes, because many of them know the most random facts about regulations. You would be surprised.
You're very smart. The farmers are very smart. Iris Gillingham of Gale Roots Farm, leading this Sunday's workshop at Farm Arts Collective in Damascus from 11 to 1. Understanding food labels, and lunches included. No reservations required. More information, though, at farmartscollective.org. Iris, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take a break and be back with more Radio Chatskill after this.
With federal funding for public media eliminated, listeners all over this country are stepping up to support public radio.
Hi, I'm Ilsa Chang from All Things Considered.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe from Weekend Edition. We're here to share a little of what people are saying. Kyle in Brooklyn says, I'm skipping two lattes a month to keep Steve Inskeep in my ear each morning. We see you and thank you, Kyle.
Farouk in El Paso, Texas says, public radio is one of the key bloodlines of this country, keeping communities connected. Thank you, Farouk.
And Diane in Juneau, Alaska says, I'm so sorry this day has come. You have my support as long as I am able. Thanks, Diane.
If you have already made your gift to the station, or if you're a sustaining donor, seriously, thank you.
If not, please join the movement to protect public radio today and tell us why you're stepping up.
Here's how to donate, and thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, we're staying on the farm. This time we're heading to Hilly Acres Farm in Jeffersonville. They're hosting a community-wide farm fest on Saturday. Think hay rides, live music, exhibits, farm animals. Tanya Hahn is the heart behind the farm, and she is here to tell us what's in store. Tanya, hi.
How are you today?
I'm good, and Farm Fest just around the corner. How are you doing?
Well, you know, we've had a few glitches this week. We need the rain, but we didn't need the rain today, but we're working around it. But we're making progress, and we're looking forward to folks coming over and sharing the farm with us on Saturday.
And talk to folks about what inspired you and the team to organize this community event.
Well, there's a lot of history to it. First and foremost, our eldest, Michael, is really, he's really the heart behind the farm. He always wanted to be a farmer, went to college, came home, with his degrees in ag and et cetera, and said, this is what we need to do. We need to open the farm up to the public so they understand where their food comes from, what a small farm operation looks like compared to a commercial farm. So we tried it. The first year we get about 50 people. The next year we got a little more. And now it's become an annual event in September, and we probably see, upwards of 400 people come through the door, every year. It's free admission. You know, folks get to come in and really have a fun filled day for the kids, for the adults. This year there's a little bit of a spin. My day job, I work at the Jeff Bank, and one of our employees, Jackie Poley, passed away unexpectedly, in July. Young mother, two kids, and the employees said, you know, we got to do something. And so they put their heads together. They wanted to do some kind of a fundraiser. And I said, well, you know, Jackie was about events, so let's do it at Farm Fest. So in fact, they were here last night helping me put tents up and stuff. And, they're going to have baskets, gift type baskets. And these baskets they're unbelievable what folks have put into them. Everything from, food, cheeses, different types of, alcoholic beverages. I mean, just really unique stuff. And folks can, it's a type of a penny social raffle type fundraiser. So, you know, they're just beautiful. So they'll, that's what this is all going to be about.
Yeah, it's a great
year. We're going to dedicate it to Jackie, to her kids, to her family. We want the kids to come and enjoy the day. It's going to be a good day, a fun day, a happy day.
It's a great day to capture that community spirit and remembrance of Jackie as well. Talk about some of those demonstrations and exhibits. You've got 4-H and FFA there.
Yeah,
what will folks see?
FFA, they're a cool bunch of kids that will do face painting. They're going to have all kinds of games. Abby Half, who's a member of the 4-H group that'll be here, will have her pony Archie here so the kids can hang out with Archie. The 4-H kids will have, they do soap felting. I'm not even sure how you do that, but it was a real hit last year.
You'll learn.
Yeah. And they'll have, they'll have cider and they'll have a hot chocolate if it's cool, which doesn't sound like it's going to be too cool, and they'll have a whole bunch of different activities for the kids to do. We'll also have, pumpkin decorating that we'll do it in one of the buildings. We'll have the yarn spinners, the weavers. They're gonna come and they'll show you how they spin their yarn and make different garments out of it, which I think is always pretty cool. Definitely not my wheelhouse, but quite a bunch of talented folks. We're gonna have food from right from the farm. We're gonna have drinks. We're gonna have different vendors that will show off their goods, from food to equipment to you name it. We also have rides for the kids besides the hay rides.
Yeah,
and I was have a barrel train ride that's being built for us right now. So the kids will get to have a ride around the farm in the barrels.
But I feel like we're missing the headline here. Animal encounters. We get to meet the animals.
Oh, the animals. What?
Can you
you hit the nail on the head. So we've got Ruben, our donkey, who's usually the star of the show. Ruben and his flock of sheep will be here. We also have six kids or baby goats, and these guys are really cool. There's two that in particular that were bottle goats. That means we have to hand feed them. And they are so friendly. They just want attention.
Wait, Ruben has his own flock of sheep?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Ruben is king of the farm there.
He is the king of the farm. Absolutely. So the kids will get to do, hang out with the goats. And yesterday we had a litter of piglets. So there'll be, some piglets from age 3 days to age 3 months for folks to hang out with. And of course our American British White Park cows, will have, two in particular that are super, cool cows. One's, Sweetheart. She's a White Park, and Marmalade, who is a cross between a White Park and a, Hereford. That's why I named her Marmalade. They'll be able to hang out with the cows as well. We'll have more cows here, but those two in particular like to have a few scratches on the neck.
They're the stars of the show there, too. Let's remind folks where they can get more information about Farm Fest coming up on Saturday.
Sure. They can go to our Facebook page. They can go to our website. They can call us. They can message us. We've been doing a lot of Instagram posts. So you name it. It's out there. Our website's got some info, but it's going to be a fun day.
That's Tanya Hahn of Hilly Acres Farm.
I just want to mention it's a good day for people to learn about where their food comes from.
Exactly. That's what we were just saying with Iris Gillingham from Gail Roots Farm just before you came on. She was on talking about Know Your Farmer, right? Great day to do that. Saturday at 11. It looks like it's going to be clearing up with the rain, so you can get to Hilly Acres Farm there. More information on their Facebook page or their website, hillyacrefarms.com, and you'll get to meet the spotlight animals there, the cows, Ruben and his flock of sheep. A great day of community spirit. Thank you so much, Tanya.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate the time.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll get a preview of a night of Brazilian jazz in Honesdale. That's coming up. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Farm and Country, from sweet and mild to spicy and hot, the first annual Pepperfest kicks off in Damascus, Pennsylvania. We sat down with the Pepperfest planning committee to get a sneak peek of what folks can expect.
This is Naga Viper. And you can tell by the name, right?
Yeah.
That it's going to bite you on the tongue.
Spicy.
Yeah, look at that.
That's this week on Farm and Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Think you have asbestos in your house? Our expert shares why you don't have to rush to panic, most of the time.
Let sleeping dogs lie is a pretty good rule of thumb, but once you start to disturb things like asbestos or lead, it becomes airborne, and now it's causing trouble.
Plus, 1 year after Hurricane Helene touched down in North Carolina, This Old House revisits the year of rebuilding. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour.
Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Jazz trombonist Ryan Keberle is bringing the vibrant sounds of Brazil to Honesdale tomorrow. His new album, Coro das Águas, created in collaboration with Collective do Brasil, blends coro rhythms with modern jazz in a fresh, compelling way. The group will perform live at the Cooperage Project, giving audiences a chance to experience the music in that community-centered setting. And let's listen to a little bit of Quintessence from the group. Ryan Keberle joins us live now. Ryan, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure, Tim. Thanks for having me on.
And your new album, now I hope I say this right, Coro das Águas, is available. Can you tell us about the inspiration behind it and what listeners can expect?
Absolutely. Well, this is the third album from my band Collective do Brasil, which is a band based in Sao Paulo. All three of my bandmates are here. They just arrived a few days ago from Brazil. We played at Small's Jazz Club last night, and we're headed up now with this music that is inspired not only by the Brazilian folk tradition of choro music, but more specifically by one of the great living songwriters of Brazil named Ivan Lins. And as I said, this is our third album that we've released over the last 6 years, and each of those albums has been inspired by these incredibly compelling composers, singers, songwriters from Brazil that are largely unknown in the U.S., which is crazy because in Brazil, they're pop stars. They are larger than life. They're like the Paul McCartneys of Brazil, except they're writing music that's heavily influenced by jazz. And I've always been drawn to music that is sophisticated in musical ways, but that still finds a way to connect with average listeners. In other words, you know, you don't need a doctorate degree in jazz in order to enjoy the music that we're making. I think there's really something for everyone, literally. So most of the music we're playing is from this new album, Coro das Águas, and most of it is written by Ivan Lins. And then myself and my bandmates reimagine these songs, and we try to bring an American jazz sensibility to each of the compositions.
So talk a little bit more about that approach to merging the styles of the Brazilian choro traditions and jazz into your arrangements.
Yeah, well, you know, as a freelance trombonist based in New York for 20 plus years. Now I am still very active in that community, but I live in the Catskills now. I live in Forestburg and have been here for 5 plus years. You know, working in as a freelancer, you have to become fluent in many different musical languages. And so over that time period, that really became one of the things that allowed me to stay busy. And through that process, learning so much about different musical traditions from around the world. And one that really connected with me deeply was Brazilian music, just in general, the folk music of Brazil loves trombone. When you go down to Brazil and you go to like your average Brazilian restaurant and there's the band playing, you know, in the corner playing background music, there is a good chance there's a trombonist in that band. It really is almost a folkloric instrument. And that was kind of my entry point. But like I said, I then proceeded to fall in love with the songwriting traditions, and in particular, the traditions from the last 50 plus years, some more recent traditions, 60s, 70s, 80s. And so I took it upon myself really over the last decade or so to try and become fluent in those musical traditions, just like I had done with other styles of music as a freelancer. And, you know, as a composer and arranger, which is how I spend a lot of my time these days besides playing trombone, that's really kind of what you have to do if you want to find a way to channel the music that you're studying or that you're listening to and loving in that moment into your own compositions. You have to become fluent in those musical styles. And every musical style has their own vocabulary, so to speak, its own types of rhythms and its own melodic phrases, its own unique way to construct the chords throughout the song, of course, the types of instruments that they use, you know, more obvious things like tempo and groove. So all of that goes into kind of defining any particular musical style. And for me, these popular musical styles of Brazil, really defined by folks like Ivan Lins, other people that have defined those traditions that our listeners might know of, are the great vocalist Elis Regina and Milton Nascimento. It's, for me, I just find it endlessly entertaining. It's really all I've listened to over the last 8 or so years, and I still feel like I'm just scratching the surface. They never exported the music to America for some reason.
For folks who are not familiar with Brazilian rhythms or this tradition, when you bring it to the Cooperage coming up from the city to the Cooperage tomorrow night, what do you hope folks experience during this concert?
Well, number one, I hope that they get up and dance, or at least feel like getting up and dancing, because that is one of the, I would say, commonalities between this style of Brazilian music and American jazz, is they are both very much built on dance music traditions. The grooves are infectious, and especially played by this band straight from Brazil. Talk about fluent in those traditions. These three bandmates of mine live and breathe this music, and it's just so rhythmically infectious. So I hope people feel that rhythmic energy through their bodies. I hope they leave humming some of these gorgeous Ivan Lins melodies, and I hope we can transport them somewhere over the 75 minutes or so of music. The more I play, the more I teach, I really see music as a form of communication, and hence my analogy, with this idea of becoming fluent. And so when we're up there on stage, it's, like going to hear a great public speaker, or maybe a group of public speakers talking about a subject that you really find interesting, and each of them are experts and have this command not only of the subject, but a very, clear and compelling and maybe even entertaining way to talk about a subject. And that's, I kind of equate that to what we're trying to do there on stage when we are sharing our musical stories with the audiences at the Cooperage Project tomorrow night.
Is the new album out now, or is it available for pre-order? Where can folks find it?
It sure is. It is out and available. They can listen to it anywhere that they typically listen to music, including all streaming services, download services, Apple Music, Spotify, even on YouTube. They can also, if they want to get hard copies, can go to my website, ryancoverly.com. They can also find it on places like Amazon. So, yeah, it is out now, and we are very, very excited to bring it back home, so to speak, and share it with our friends here in the Sullivan County and Wayne County region.
All right. That's Ryan Keverly. His group, Collective do Brasil, is performing tomorrow at the Cooperage with some great Brazilian music, the great Brazilian jazz and those traditions. There's more information at thecooperageproject.org. And you can find out more about Ryan at ryankeverly.com. And Ryan, I think we have another track here to play as we go out. This is SMRA?
Yeah, SMRA. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you, Tim.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Reminder, tonight, it is the 20th anniversary screening of Good Night and Good Luck at the Big Eddie Film Festival in Narrowsburg. That's at the Tustin Theater, starting at 7. The fundraiser, actually, for Radio Chatskill, $10 from each ticket sold, will be donated to the station. And panelists include award-winning journalists Pete Madden, Elizabeth Hope Williams, and Steve Yacino. That's tonight again at 7, the Big Eddie Film Festival. And you can hear Ryan and Collective do Brasil. This great music at the Cooperage tomorrow. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Tavern on Main, a neighborhood bar and grill on Main Street in Jeffersonville, featuring local American fare, Saturday and Sunday brunch, and Thursday trivia nights. Menu and hours online at tavernonmainny.com.
How we make sense of the news and the world keeps changing. Who to trust and what's real are other moving targets. Let On the Media be your guide.
Saturday afternoon at 4.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, the rain and showers continue today with the possibility of some major thunderstorms or heavy thunderstorms this afternoon after 5. Tonight, cloudy with a low near 60. A brief shower or two continuing through tomorrow and a high of 73. But the rain should move out for the weekend. Cloudy Saturday and Sunday with highs in the mid-70s.